pretty much straight up in the air. There are no residents or anyone in the immediate vicinity.
A tanker carrying liquid methane rolls over on the park's highway. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 18th of August. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young talks about next week's primary.
Who says I'm facing a tough battle in the primary?
We'll profile Young and his Republican challengers tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell Engineers, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services on the web at dowell.com.
A tanker rollover at mile 179 on the park's highway has stalled north and southbound traffic all day. The tanker carrying 9,000 gallons of liquid methane is currently venting the gas, and emergency personnel have the area secured. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Director of Emergency Services for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, Dennis Broutigan, says the situation is under control and the methane gas in the tank is being vented into the atmosphere.
The tanks are set up that they have a vent so that if there's any pressure that does build up in the tank, that is vented out into the atmosphere. So there is a controlled venting taking place at this point in time.
The tanker rollover occurred shortly before 9 this morning. Matsu Borough hazmat teams responded from Wasilla, and rescue and ambulance crews were dispatched from Talkeetna. Hazmat teams from Fort Richardson and Elmendorf Air Force Base were also called on to help with the emergency. Broutigan says the methane gas is extremely explosive. The controlled venting reduces the risk of explosion.
The gas is going pretty much straight up in the air, and there are no residents, no houses or cabins or anyone in the immediate vicinity. The railroad is actually upwind, so it is not in danger.
He says an area around the tanker has been closed off for about a mile in every direction. The gas, if inhaled, can cause serious injury or death. Broutigan says there is little likelihood of the gas doing any harm to animals on the ground. The tanker is operated by TG Services of Wasilla. Tanker driver Robert Adkins, aged 63, suffered only minor injuries in the rollover. The park's highway was shut down at about 5 miles above and below the accident site.
At some point in time, they'll make a decision to perhaps offload that product into another tanker and right the vehicle and clean the mess up. However, it's not estimated that's going to happen anytime before 6 p.m. and maybe later.
Fairbanks Natural Gas Company has sent two cranes to the scene to lift the tanker after the gas is safely vented. It's estimated the parks will be closed until about 8 p.m. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
For most elections, the state of Alaska caps campaign contributions at $500 from individuals and $1,000 from political action committees. But on ballot measures, money is treated as a form of free speech, so there's no limit. Spending on one measure dwarfs everything else on Alaska's August 26th primary ballot. One side calls it a clean water initiative. The other calls it an anti-mining measure. The mining industry, environmental groups, and at least one mystery donor have poured more than $8 million into the initiative. KTOO's John Ryan has the story.
Measure 4 would stop any new metal mining operations of at least 640 acres from releasing toxic pollutants into the water in amounts affecting salmon or human health. It would also stop the new operations from storing wastes in any way that could release toxic substances into the water. Bruce Switzer is a former mining consultant from Arizona. He's the chief technical advisor to the Measure 4 supporters. He says it's squarely aimed at one mine, the proposed Pebble Mine on Bristol Bay.
This would be the biggest open pit mine in North America. The overburden is all acid generating. Any mine that has been built in conditions that remotely resemble the hydrologic conditions of Bristol Bay has contaminated the surrounding water, and that's thoroughly documented.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says Bristol Bay provides about a quarter of Alaska's commercial salmon catch, or about as much as all of Southeast Alaska's harvest. The advertising in favor of Measure 4 focuses on the Pebble Mine and Bristol Bay, but the measure itself never mentions them. That's because the state constitution forbids ballot measures that would affect just one part of the state. Here's Bruce Switzer.
It is not a perfect mechanism, but it was the only one that was available.
The mining industry says whatever the intended target, Measure 4 would shut down metal mining across the state. Lorna Shaw is the executive director of the Council of Alaska Producers. That's the association of companies that operate large metal mines. Let me read a little text from the measure. It says, Section 2 of this act does not apply to existing large-scale metallic mineral mining operations that have received all required federal, state, and local permits, authorizations, licenses, and approvals on or before the effective date of this act, or to future operations of existing facilities at those sites. So that seems pretty straightforward to me, that existing facilities would not be shut down or affected by this act.
That's the key. What's an existing facility? If you go out to an existing mine today, like Fort Knox, for example, you know, the mine's been there since 1996. It's 10 years old. That's an existing facility. But right now, today, they're constructing a heap leach project. That is a new facility at an existing mine. And mines, they don't have all of their permits and all of their facilities in place forever. Hopefully, to extend their life, they're going to be adding those new facilities.
The state's largest metal mines, like Fort Knox and the Red Dog, are well above the threshold of 640 acres. That's equal to 1 square mile. The Kensington Gold Mine, now under construction north of Juneau, doesn't have all its necessary permits, but the Alaska Department of Natural Resources says the mine would occupy about 550 acres or less. That would make Kensington, under its current plans, too small to be covered by Measure 4. Southeast Alaska's largest mine is the Greens Creek Mine on Admiralty Island. According to the DNR, the mine is about 500 acres. The Council of Alaska Producers says it's about 350. Either way, too small to be affected by Measure 4 without a major expansion. But Hecla, the Idaho company that owns Greens Creek, has given $1 million to fight Measure 4. Bill Olklaus with the Greens Creek Mine says measuring the acreage of a mine is difficult. He says the company is concerned the initiative could hurt their operations.
We have decided there are possibilities for effects from this measure. It's written so broadly and so disjointedly that the way it's applied in the future is not at all clear.
Measure 4 advisor Bruce Switzer says most mines can operate without running afoul of Measure 4, but the Pebble Mine straddles miles of some of Alaska's most productive salmon streams.
Under the hydrologic conditions that they're faced with there, it's going to be impossible to mine there without contaminating those streams.
You don't think that's true of other large mines and other...
None that are so far proposed.
Both sides of the Measure 4 debate accuse their opponents of scare tactics and deception. Both campaign groups call themselves Alaskans for something, but if you follow the money trail, the groups are largely not Alaskan. According to the Alaska Public Offices Commission, the so-called Alaskans Against the Mining Shutdown is funded mostly by multinational mining companies that operate in Alaska. The British and Canadian owners of the Pebble Mine have given about $4 million. The so-called Alaskans for Clean Water has gotten most of its funding from an advocacy group called Americans for Job Security, based in Alexandria, Virginia. According to the Alaska Public Offices Commission, Americans for Job Security gave $1.2 million. Measure 4's next biggest funder is investment banker Robert Gillum of Anchorage. He gave $250,000, according to campaign filings. Americans for Job Security did not return phone calls. The advocacy group usually funds advertising against government regulation and taxes. The group's website says Americans for Job Security doesn't disclose its funding sources. The organization paid for a series of pro-Measure 4 ads, saying the Pebble Mine would put fishing jobs at risk. According to public filings, the mining industry has outspent Measure 4's backers, whoever they are, by about 3-1. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
The Pogo Mine has overcome early setbacks and is now turning a profit. The state's second largest gold mine poured its first gold in early 2006 after construction costs ran $50 million over budget. The underground mining operation went on to suffer a major electrical fire, problems with ore processing equipment, and trouble filling key jobs. Carl Hanneman of Techcomeco Alaska says things have turned around in the last year.
We've turned the corner now and are more consistently meeting our production targets and have reported a profit for the last three quarters.
Hanneman says the mine celebrated the pouring of its 500,000th ounce of gold in June. The mine is projected to produce more than 3 million ounces during a 10-year lifespan. Hanneman says economics at Pogo, like at all mines, is a balance between operational costs and mineral prices.
Well, certainly the high price of gold is helping us significantly at this point to offset the very major increases we've had in electricity and fuel costs and such. And on balance now, the price of gold, at least of late, is winning, and we're on the profit side.
Hanneman says the worldwide recent mining boom, sparked by high mineral prices, continues to make it challenging to find and keep good workers. He says plans are still in the works to use Pogo Gold in the manufacture of medals for the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, studying an underappreciated home for juvenile salmon.
These streams are fairly unrecognized as being significant fish habitat.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Inlet Tower Hotel and Suites, offering banquets and catering services from private dining to business conferences to wedding banquets. Information on hotel amenities online at inlettower.com. APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
In the lead-up to the congressional primary election next week, Don Young is facing his most serious re-election challenge in many years. APRN's Lori Townsend has more on the three-way Republican primary race for Alaska's lone seat in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Don Young is raising a lot of money for his campaign effort, but much of it is bleeding out the door as quickly as it's coming in to attorneys battling investigations into Young's conduct. So far, more than $1 million has been paid to lawyers because he is under a criminal investigation regarding a Florida earmark and his ties to former VCO head Bill Allen. Young says he will be vindicated. And for now, he's focused on the issues. He says costly energy and the dependence on foreign supplies is one of the biggest problems facing the nation. But he says we don't get it.
We are probably the dumbest group of people collectively in the world. You know, the price of oil dropped. It was $145, and now it's down to $122, and everything. Oh, this all is gone. They don't understand the peak oil concept. The demand worldwide, and we put ourselves right back into the lap of those that we buy oil from.
Young says if legislation to open ANWR had passed 10 years ago, gas would be 55 cents cheaper at the pump today. Young supports more hydropower, liquefied coal, and small-scale nuclear plants like the reactor being proposed for Galena. Although his challenger, Sean Parnell, is pulling strong polling numbers, Young abruptly ended an interview with APRN DC reporter Libby Casey when she asked a question about a tough primary battle.
Who says I'm facing a tough battle in the primary?
Let me rephrase. You're facing a tougher challenge in the primary than you have in recent years.
Yeah, I'm facing the first, second primary I've ever had, and I will win the primary, and I'll win the general election. And you don't need Captain Zero. You need somebody that can do the job back here, and I'm one that can do the job, have been doing the job. Again, it's not about me. It's about the state. That's enough. I've said all I'm going to say.
Okay.
I'd say we're through.
Okay.
We're through.
Okay.
Sean Parnell is currently the lieutenant governor for Alaska, but he also served two terms in the Alaska House and one in the Senate, and he worked in the state's division of oil and gas. Parnell has had a law practice in Alaska since 1987. He says he's running against Don Young because he wants to bring fiscal sanity back to Washington. He says Alaskans have lost faith in their leadership.
Without that trust, there is no foundation for policy. So, and also when you have leadership that goes for out-of-control spending without regard to the deficit we're leaving our children, the debt that they're going to have to pay, I think that's irresponsible. That's something I want to change.
Parnell says the high cost of fuel is the number one problem facing Alaska. He says he believes Governor Palin's gas tax suspension plan and $1,200 cash payment to all Alaskans is good short-term relief. But he says the federal government also needs to help by reducing taxes.
Why not leave more tax dollars in taxpayer hands? Why not increase the dependents exemption from $3,500 to $7,000? Why not take down tax rates for individuals? That puts real dollars in people's hands. And then we can talk about the energy options as well with respect to increasing supply, developing our own resources that we have here that we're so rich with, and also increasing supply and decreasing demand.
Parnell says more offshore exploration in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and speeding North Slope gas to market should be a big priority. He says he wants to change the nation's view of Alaska from a state that takes too many federal dollars to one that brings value to the country. Kodiak lawmaker Gabrielle Ledoux is also challenging Don Young, and like the other two candidates, Ledoux thinks energy is the big issue and ANWR is the answer.
But of course, at the same time, you can't forget alternative energy sources. And in Alaska, we are really lucky here in Alaska. We have such an abundance of alternative energy sources. And then finally, you can't forget conservation. And what happened in Juneau when their hydro went down a couple of months ago actually shows that conservation can work.
Ledoux says if she is elected to Congress and Democrats maintain the majority, she will be able to comfortably work across party lines. She says although earmarks have taken on a negative connotation recently, it's unrealistic to think they can and should be eliminated.
As far as I'm concerned, I mean, that's an essential reason why you're going to Congress, in order to try to get a fair shake for your communities. Yes, there have been some problems with the earmarking process. There may have been some abuses, but that doesn't mean you throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Ledoux says she thinks Alaskans are tired of the same old style of politics and are ready for change. The primary election will be held on August 26th. In Anchorage, I'm Lori Townsend.
Tune in this week for stories on the Republican and Democrat primary matchups in both congressional races up for grabs this election season. In 6 months, television viewers who aren't ready for the conversion to digital will be out of luck and unable to watch broadcast TV. Federal law requires TV stations to switch over to a digital signal on February 17, 2009. The FCC estimates that 20% of Americans still don't know about the changeover, so they're ramping up public education efforts in the coming weeks. Today, the FCC announced a nationwide outreach program to visit 80 cities that need the most help. Anchorage and Fairbanks are at the top of the list and will be visited by an FCC commissioner next week. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin said today in Washington, D.C., that the places being targeted either have more than 100,000 households or 15% of households that rely solely on over-the-air TV signals.
And as part of our efforts to try to prepare consumers for this transition, we've identified all the television markets in which the largest number of viewers will have to take action to be prepared to continue to watch television 6 months from now.
Martin says, while there are some major cities like New York and San Francisco on the list, rural communities are especially unprepared. He says the groups most vulnerable include people living in tribal areas, minorities, seniors, non-English speakers, the disabled, and people with low incomes.
Recognizing the challenges that many of these viewers in these communities may face, the Commission has unanimously agreed to travel throughout the country, coast to coast, to hold public events with community leaders, local broadcasters, and other stakeholders to try to highlight the steps that consumers are going to need to take to be prepared for that transition again. That's next February of 2009.
Martin says the commissioners will hold town hall meetings, workshops, and roundtables, and do media outreach. One possibility they'll explore is doing a soft test, which means temporarily turning off the analog signal to figure out how ready people are. The change to digital will affect anyone who uses a TV antenna or rabbit ears. Consumers will need a TV with a digital tuner or a converter box. Cable customers shouldn't have to make any changes, and TV sets sold in stores since March are required to be digital ready. Every household can request two coupons worth $40 each towards purchasing digital to analog converter boxes. They're online at dtv2009.gov.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing personal attention from people who live and work right here in Alaska. Wells Fargo, the next stage. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Petersburg's hospital may stop delivering babies on a routine basis next year. Physicians are recommending the change due to a substantial decline in the number of local births. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
In 1987, Petersburg Medical Center staff delivered 45 babies here in town, and 20 years later, that number had dropped to 7. There are several factors causing this decline, according to hospital administrator John Bringhurst.
We've got a situation where we have fewer women of childbearing age to start with. Then we have those women who are childbearing age electing to have fewer children. And then there appear to be more women who are interested in having anesthesia for their delivery and so are going somewhere where they can get that done.
Petersburg's lack of an anesthesiologist is important because it means the hospital cannot do a cesarean section if there are serious complications during a birth. That presents a risk for local deliveries, according to Dr. Doug Long, one of the medical center's three physicians who are recommending the hospital discontinue its routine labor and delivery services next year.
The risks of delivering a baby in a small hospital like Petersburg are namely that we don't have the ability to do C-sections here currently. The main limitation is anesthesia.
And without the capability of doing C-sections, a birth that develops complications could become more risky and result in the need for a costly medevac out of town. In addition, the low number of local births means less opportunity for support staff to gain regular experience in obstetrics, or OB, according to Long.
To be available to come in and help with the labor and delivery, know where everything is, keep the equipment and everything ready to go, and to be able to deal with the emergencies is a tall order and a lot of work when you don't have a lot of reinforcement with the experience of doing a number of deliveries every year.
Long says staff members recently voted to recommend that the hospital stop offering routine deliveries after all the hospital's current prenatal patients have given birth. The last routine birth would be sometime early next year. Long says the hospital would continue to provide full prenatal and postpartum care for mothers.
We can continue to take care of pregnant patients, and that we can provide their prenatal care and all the laboratory and imaging support work that they need. We can do emergency deliveries and will maintain the ability to do emergency deliveries. It's just that the routine deliveries would be done elsewhere.
The hospital board is slated to take up the recommendation for a vote at its next board meeting September 4th. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
This summer, biologists on the lower Kenai Peninsula have been studying some unlikely juvenile salmon habitat. KBBI's Emily Schwing went along for a day of fieldwork and filed this report.
Cooey Walker is a watershed specialist with the Kachemak Bay Research Reserve. She's been conducting research in streams on the lower Kenai Peninsula for the last 4 years. We're headed to a site called Nank 44 Lower. That's short for the lower reach of Site 44 on the North Fork of the Anchor River. Walker says her research sites are unique in comparison with other salmon streams in Alaska.
They sit on this geologic base of uplifted sea sediments that then have, you know, glacial deposits on top. But, you know, when you look at the bluffs and you see all the coal seams, I mean, that's all old seabed floor, as opposed to the hard rock geology on the south side of the bay or the hard rock geology further north up the Kenai Peninsula.
The purpose of the study is to define the relationship between the surrounding landscape and fish habitat in headwater streams. This is where streams begin, and much of the water here is sourced from groundwater. Walker says oftentimes headwaters seem narrow and obscure, but she and her colleagues have been surprised to find over 250,000 fish in these streams collectively.
So we have up in these upper reaches, we have coho, which are silver salmon. We have some juvenile chinook, which are the king salmon. We have a lot of Dolly Varden, and we sometimes get steelhead.
Walker says her research is important in light of the development that is already happening near many of her research sites.
Why we're trying to really, you know, focus on these headwater streams right now is that they are very strongly connected to the surrounding landscape. And that means not just the adjacent, you know, 50 meters or whatever. It could mean that the support for these streams is coming from a long distance away. And so this is where it gets really important for development. Because if you were, say, building a road on a slope that was maybe 100 meters away from a stream, you might ditch the uphill side of that road and to redirect that water to keep it off the road. Well, that water possibly could be feeding the groundwater that supports the stream that's 100 meters away.
Walker says global warming could also play a role in changing juvenile fish habitat.
Well, global warming is going to change, of course, the temperature, and these headwater streams are very closely connected to the air temperature. And also, global warming will probably change groundwater flows because as it'll probably, cause more evaporation. I mean, there'll be less just groundwater input, and it might change where the groundwater comes from. So we don't know exactly how it's going to change, but we know it will change.
In 2006, researchers from the Kachemak Bay Research Reserve, along with scientists from Baylor University in Texas and the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, conducted a pilot study in 30 headwater streams on the peninsula. This year, the University of South Florida has joined the group, and they've narrowed down the number of sites to include the headwaters of the Anchor, the Stariski, and the Nanilchik Rivers. While I swat at mosquitoes and listen for sandhill cranes, Becky Shaftel and Julie Baldassar shock fish. The two biologists use a special instrument to send a small electrical charge through the water. This doesn't hurt the fish, it just makes them easy to catch. Shaftel and Baldassar will count, weigh, and identify the fish before they're released back to the stream. The team is also classifying the plants and insects that live along the stream banks, and they take water chemistry samples, which will be analyzed back at the lab. No other study like this has been fielded on the Lower Kenai Peninsula, and Walker says nearly everything is a new discovery.
What we're learning is what fish live here and what the habitat is like. And we don't know any of that until we start sampling what the fish are and what the habitat is like. And these streams are fairly unrecognized as being significant fish habitat. In fact, like in 2006 when we did our first study, half the streams that we sampled had not been cataloged yet as anadromous streams. And so nobody knew that there were any salmon in them at all. So it's all a discovery process. So that on the very first level, just what's in here, what's the habitat like?
Reporting from the North Fork of the Anchor River, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from John Ryan in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Emily Schwing in Homer, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Laurie Townsend and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menaker. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. Have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org. APRN would like to thank the Alaska Railroad Corporation for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
Attention voters! Tuesday, August 26th is primary election day. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. For additional information or other accommodations, please contact the Division of Elections at 907-465-4611, TTY TDD 907-465-3020. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
APRN would like to thank Northern Air Cargo for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.